From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
Welcome back to Little Cuts, our mini-soda re-dig into the things that we've been watching, I think, recently. I'm Terry.
Sorry, Jesus.
Mary Beth.
And Shirky. I'm Mary Beth. This week, we are chatting about lesbians, melodious dragons, trans cinema, an intense queer thriller, South by Southwest, and Blue Men in Habsburgs. Blue Men, where your feet at?
Blue Men, where your feet at?
Real quick, before we get into this, though, I do want to make two small announcements. One, we are nominated for a motherfucking Rondo. That's cool
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, we are.
You should vote for us. We will have the email to send your vote in the description of the podcast. It's super easy. You just have to email your ballot. You can just vote for us. You can vote for Dread Central for all four categories we're nominated in. You know, whatever. It's fine. But yeah, you should vote for us because it's cool as hell that we're nominated and I would love to win because now I'm getting very competitive.
I mean, we're sort of like the underdog in this because there are some that have a big audience out there that are nominated.
We're better than every single one of them. I don't know. I would love, if you guys can vote, it would mean the world to us.
It really would.
It's a huge honor to be, I know that sounds cheesy, it is an honor to be nominated and to be recognized by that, but it would be even cooler to win. So if you can vote for us, that would be awesome.
I never expected
yeah,
a Rondo nomination. It's really cool. As someone that's been following
cool
that
hell.
For a very long time, it's really cool.
You don't care about awards until you're nominated. You're like, I'm cooler than that. Then you get nominated. You're like, I'm a shill. I don't care anymore. This is really cool. I have to be honest about who I am as a person. Second announcement. Terry and I, both of us motherfuckers, will be at the Unnamed Footage Festival.
We sure will.
For the whole thing. Yeah. Dread Central will have an analog horror block on Saturday, hosted by me at 3:30 p.m., Chris Straub from Local 58 will be there for a Q&A afterward, but Terry and I will be hanging out all weekend, so if anyone is going, come chill. We'll just be watching found footage movies and vibing and eating the incredible fried chicken from the place next door to the theater. So,
yes,
come chill. Even though it's like a Dread Central block, we will both be there the whole time, so it's Scarred for Life Central. So
it sure is. And we'll have stickers, so... Come
we
say
will have
hi.
Stickers. We will have friendship. We will have hugs. So,
all the
I
above.
Just wanted to announce those two things.
I'm glad you did.
Because it's already March, and I don't know. It's halfway through March.
Yeah.
And
wild.
Yeah. I don't get it. But yeah. So yeah, those are the two announcements that I had for everybody today before we started.
Very big ones. Okay. Movies though. And this is a very queer episode, it seems like. So let's start off with
lesbians. It's a very, very gay episode. Okay, I saw Love Lives Bleeding, Terry.
Oh, I cannot wait.
I saw it.
I'm hoping
I won't spoil anything
this weekend. I'm hoping.
But let me just tell you, it's beautiful. It's just so good. It's so weird, and I love Rose Glass, and it's the gayest movie I've ever seen. Not actually, but very close. This is a movie that, like, I know everyone is, like, clowns on the idea of the female gaze, but this is, like, the first movie since Portrait of a Lady on Fire that actually is, like, really interrogating what a queer female gaze looks like and what that means to actually, like, revert the idea of desire and what the camera is projecting and desire onto these bodies. But to back it up, just out of my academic bullshit, this is the newest Kristen Stewart film, directed by Rose Glass, who did St. Maud. But Kristen Stewart stars in it as the most incredible, sad, little, soft butch of your dreams, who runs the manager of a gym in a middle of nowhere town in the Midwest, in like the kind of like mid-ish wester of the Midwest. I can't remember what state, but she runs this gym, and who rolls into town but this beautiful woman who is a bodybuilder, played by Katie M. O'Brien, who is an actual bodybuilder. You've seen her in the likes of things like The Mandalorian. But here, they fall in love, and it is the most incredible depiction of how quickly lesbians move in relationships that I've ever seen. And the toxicity that can come from queer relationships. It's like a very much look at toxic queer relationships. It's not like, it's like a beautiful, super passionate relationship, but it's also very toxic. And so it's a really cool look at that and what that kind of toxicity looks like, but also is just playing so much with expectations of the masculine versus feminine. And it's just bloody and fucked up and weird and hot. And there's so much fucking pussy eating, and like, it's just incredible, because again, like, we don't get movies that are like crime thrillers that are so casual about lesbian sex and like queer sex, and I love that. Like, we always see these movies about like guys being cool and having sex with chicks, but here it's like chicks having sex with chicks, and the power dynamics are much more on equal playing field. And it's just so beautifully done. Rose Glass, like, really is solidifying her place as like the next big thing.
I really can't wait to see it, because St. Maud was so good. It was so good.
It's so different, yeah. But like the same in terms of just the weird vibes. Like, Rose Glass is so good at taking these genres and making them feel uncanny. And like, they are familiar, but also very different. And she's doing that here with like that Americana crime thriller. And it's so gay and goes to some weird places, but in the best way possible. And Ed Harris is actually also incredible in this movie with his skullet. Dave Franco plays a terrible piece of shit. I saw this in a theater full of queer, like, femmes, and everyone was cheering. It was like it was magic,
because
it was
half press,
half it was like a half press, half public. So it wasn't just like people watching it for work. It was like, there was a group of people that came in, and everyone, I looked AFAB, but it was definitely like a queer group of friends. And someone goes, "Is Rabbit coming?" And I was like, "I love queer people. Is Rabbit coming?" Like, that's the most non-binary name. And it's just like, the fact that I was in a space, like, exactly, like, the fact that I was in a space like that was so comforting, in that, like, everyone kind of was on the same page, so there was no, like, weirdness. It was just, like, everyone was stoked to watch, like, lesbians fuck shit up for 2 hours, and it was, and again, like I said, it was, like, a religious experience, like, gasping together, yelling, cheering. It was beautiful. So, Love Lies Bleeding fucking rules. I do encourage you to see it in an audience if you can, a good audience. And I don't know how to guarantee that, but like, the queers are coming out for this one. It feels like they're really marketing it well. The queers are coming out in droves. So like, fingers crossed that's true everywhere. I know I'm in a coastal city, and I'm like lucky to live in a state that's blue. Like, I will acknowledge that, but it's really good. It's really queer. The hype is real, in my humble opinion. So.
That's awesome. In chat, Tony was saying how he loved how fucking unabashedly in your face with queerness Kristen Stewart was. And that reminded me, I just saw recently, I guess she was on Colbert, and he was talking about, have you seen her Rolling Stone cover?
Oh, Oh, have I seen Ghost?
And so he was talking about how CBS didn't want him to show the cover on air, and he did it anyway. And he's like, I don't know why they would want me to show this. And I was like, it's because it's so queer and so in your face.
She's outwardly trying to say, fuck your gender expectation and gender norms. I've got a mullet and I look like a boy.
And I'm wearing a jock strap and my hand is down my crotch. Like, it's great. Like,
and it's just so fuck you. And I'm so glad that, like you said, like, whatever you think about Kristen Stewart, she's doing more for the queer community than a lot of people are doing. Like, in terms of normalizing queerness and, like, being just, like, visibly queer everywhere she goes. Like, that's super important. She's a big name. Mm-hmm. People, like, really look at her. And the fact that she is so willing to be so queer is so important. Because it's so easy to scare people to not be so butch or to be this way. And she hasn't really let that happen, at least like front facing wise.
Right.
And so it is really awesome to see her like fully lean into her queerness and embrace that as someone who has the privilege to do that.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I need to see it. There's so many movies coming out I want to watch, and I just,
it's too much.
Yeah.
It's too much.
I still haven't seen Dune 2, which I need to see. So
I know, neither have I. I'm supposed to see that this weekend. I don't have the popcorn bucket, though, unfortunately.
Oh.
That's okay. I don't really know how to relate lesbians and Melodious Dragons other than, like, lesbians love Melodious Dragons. So, like, what's going on with some dragons?
So this is the new Netflix movie, Damsel.
Oh, the Millie Bobby Brown movie?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So it was directed by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, who we love on the show from 28 Weeks Later, the director of that. Yeah, and it's a PG-13 movie, but it still manages to do a lot with that PG-13 rating. And if you're not familiar, so she plays, Millie Bobby Brown plays a commoner named Elodie, who, when the movie begins, her father gets, like, a decree that she's to marry the prince in a faraway kingdom, and she gets there. And before you know it, she is being tossed into the cave of a dragon because they had made some kind of ancient debt with the dragon that they would be giving sacrifices of the royal blood to the dragon to appease her, we come to find out. And the dragon is voiced by
Shohreh Aghadashloo.
Yeah, I believe. Yep, I believe so. I was trying to pull up, my internet is being stupid, but I was trying to pull up my cast information on it. But yeah, so she voices the dragon, and oh my god, her voice. She was meant. She was meant to voice a dragon.
That makes me so happy. Yeah, Shohreh Aghadashloo.
Aghadashloo. Yeah, and her voice is just, I love her voice. It's so good. And she brings such, like, playful gravitas to this dragon that is both, like, toying with Millie's character, but also getting more pissed off that this girl is not easier to kill. And it sort of goes from there. It's a little predictable, and I kind of wish it was a little bit more intense than it actually is. For someone that, you know, directed 28 Weeks Later. But I had a lot of fun with it. It was beautifully shot, had some really good effects. And for a Netflix PG-13 movie about dragons, it was really entertaining. And I just got to give it up for the dragon. She was stunning. She was great in it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
I'm glad she's getting more English-speaking roles.
Yeah.
I want her to be in everything.
Me too.
Oh, this was not on my radar because I don't really like Millie Bobby Brown, but I'm glad to hear it was good. I thought it was a show for some, like, this shows you how much I fucking miss been paying attention to this. I thought it was a show. Angela Bassett's in it though, which is nuts. And Robin Wright, which is nuts.
Yep,
too.
She plays the kind of evil queen, and she is deliciously eating scenery. Nick Robinson, who was Simon in the Love, Simon movies, plays the,
I was wondering why that name was familiar to me.
Yeah, okay. Plays the prince, and Angela Bassett is Millie's stepmother. And it's just, it's fun. It was a fun movie. It's like,
cool.
I don't really care one way or the other about Millie Bobby Brown, but she was decent in it. Very physical role. And they really put her through her paces. Like it's not like she didn't get injured. She gets kind of destroyed in a lot of places. Wait, does she?
I don't know if it was actually true, but she's like a flat earth. She was a flat earther, or like joked about being a flat earther. And then everyone was like, she's a flat earther. I don't actually know if that's true or not. Again, I didn't dig enough into it to like fully care. I just thought it was funny. But she might be a flat earther, or was.
Great.
I don't know. Like, this is what happens when you let children become like superstars, is they just like, yeah, Tony, everyone was like 100% joking about her being violently homophobic in a way that like, I don't understand why people thought was funny. Like, they would joke about her hitting gays with cars. And I was like, I don't understand what? Where this came from. Like, do you remember that?
I miss all of this.
Oh my god, they would like, people would like Photoshop things with like her like tweeting slurs and saying like, I like sped up and hit a gay with my car and then backed over them again to make sure they were dead. Like, it's like super weird. And like, she's never said, I don't think she said anything homophobic before. Like, so people are just like jokingly calling her homophobic.
Wow.
The internet's a very weird place, everybody. It was just like one of those things where people just made her a meme for like no other reason than she was Millie Bobby Brown. I was like, that's weird to put that on her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Wow.
Don't put children in the limelight, guys. It's a really bad idea.
Wow. Wow. Flat earther, homophobic memes. Wow. Okay. I don't know how to recover from that. But if this does sound interesting to you, it is on Netflix. And it was a fun time. I had a good time with it.
Predictable. I'm glad you did. I'm glad that Netflix is at least getting a couple wins in here with their original stuff, I guess.
Yeah. I was like, I went in with some trepidation because like it's a really cool premise. And I was, you know, I really liked the director, but I was like, it's a Netflix movie. And a lot of times recently, they're not the greatest. And
Rebel Moon, cough, cough.
Which I still haven't seen. I have no desire to see.
Don't. I watched it for 45 minutes and we turned it off, which never happens in this house. We couldn't do it. It was so boring.
Nothing matches the Okja era, though. That was a great movie. All right. Going back into queerness, let's hear about trans cinema.
So Alice Mao McKay's latest movie, Tree Walkers, is out, and I really liked it.
Yeah?
And it's out on VOD now. This is very different from the stuff she's done before. So many of you might be familiar with Alice Mao McKay. She is a trans filmmaker from Australia. She's been making films since she was about 17. I think she's 20 now. She's made 4 movies. It's like, you know, wild. Just pretty prolific queer filmmaker. A lot of like DIY punk stuff being made in Australia, like lower budget, but still, you know, making like queer movies about queer kids and starring queer people. And her latest, Tea Blockers, is actually her first like explicitly centered on a trans person. So her first two films, So Vam and Bad Girl Boogie, were focused on cis people kind of looking up to queer people and like trying to live in like a world that hates queer people. But Tea Blockers is a combo of like a Greg Araki 90s hangout movie with Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh.
Which I really, really loved. So it's a much more grounded movie. And I think you can tell how she is learning as a filmmaker and how she's growing as a filmmaker, which is really cool to see, especially because these are all being made in pretty like rapid succession.
Right.
But this one follows Sophie, who is a woman who is like not super early in her transition, but still kind of early enough that like her family, like she still kind of has a lot of wounds from her family kicking her out and not speaking to her family. And she lives with her friend, with her best friend, a non-binary person named Spencer, and they just live their best, like, crust punk, like, gay lives, like, doing poppers and getting too drunk and throwing up and smoking a lot of cigarettes and, like, working at movie theaters and wanting to be famous, but, like, not really getting there, but, like, a lot of ennui and doing drugs and, like, a trans woman talking about chasers and like doing like and taking her estrogen pills and like normalizing trans existence in a way that we don't usually see, of just like having a trans woman exist as a trans woman, not like the epitome of being the perfect trans woman or like going through this like epic story. It's more just like she's just trying to survive. And then layered on top of this is an ancient parasite has been awoken by an earthquake and is taking over all of like the straight men in town, and it is like an obvious metaphor for alt-right people trying to destroy and kill queer and trans people. And it's a really cool melding of the two, I think. I think she's found a really interesting kind of stride of trying to make both down-to-earth movies combined with the horror elements. And it's my favorite of her so far. I think that the groundedness works so well to make this feel like the emotions are much more like raised, and I think the direction and the acting and everything is just like even higher quality than she has in the past. I don't think the budgets are necessarily higher, but there just feels like there's a confidence that she's really developing in her style and like a vision that she's hitting, and like it feels like she's really hitting her stride and figuring out the kinds of movies she wants to make. Not that she didn't have a vision before, but like, you know, she's a fucking teenager, right, making horror movies. Like, you're gonna, you know, you're fucking 17. And you're so it's really cool you're to trying see to
figure how, out what worked.
Yeah. So this one is just, I think, her best work so far, because you can really see where she is moving and like how she's now really integrating all of her influences. So yeah, it's T Blockers. That is on VOD now. And I love all of her other movies, so like obviously take that with a grain of salt with my with like my kind of recommendation, but I think it's worth watching. It's an hour and 15 minutes. Cool practical effects, queer as shit, made by a trans woman who's 20. Like, if you care about, you know, not to be a dick here, but if you care about queer cinema, especially queer genre cinema, you should do yourself a favor and check it out. Even if it's not your cup of tea, it's still like pretty important kind of glimpse into what is happening in the world of horror within these communities. And I think it's like a very important place to watch, because I think all of the really cool shit are going to come from directors like Alice in the next like decade. So
I need to check her work out. I have not watched any of the thing that she's done, and I need to.
I highly recommend. People can be a little bit like, it's low budget, but she's like a 17-year-old making movies with her friends in Australia. Yeah. And like, sometimes the performances aren't perfect, but the vision is there, and I think that's what matters. Like, you can tell that she, like, she has an idea of what she wants to do. And it's, again, with T-Blockers, it's even stronger. So I'm excited. She has Satanic Panic coming out soon. And then also there's her, she's finishing up Christmas for Carnage, which is her, obviously, Christmas horror movie. So.
So many movies. And she's, I know, 20 now. It's wild.
I know. I want someone to, like, actually give her money to, like, yeah, make something instead of her, like, self-funding. I mean, self-funding is awesome, but it's, like, obviously she can do something with it. So, like, mm-hmm, give her the resources to do it. But anyway. But, yeah, that's T-Blockers. It's out on VOD now. I would highly recommend checking it out. It's, again, it's an hour and 15 minutes. It's not a long commitment. And it's just, like, good, badass, gross B movie filmmaking from a really talented young trans filmmaker. So yeah, I think we're swinging probably to the opposite end of the queer spectrum here with an intense queer thriller, but we're still gay.
We're still,
so that's great.
Very gay. And I realize saying this now, because it's only March, that it doesn't hold a lot of weight, but this movie, I've been waiting to watch it since it premiered in festivals last year. I've been dying to see it. And B, This might be my favorite movie I've seen. Well, no, it is. Hands down, my favorite movie I've seen this year. And it might be. It's Femme.
I have to watch the screener. I'm like dying to see this fucking movie.
I have been.
Tell me everything
dying
right now. Sorry.
To see Femme.
I'm like very excited. I'm like very excited to watch Femme. It's like one of my most anticipated of the year. So I'm like,
it is It is fantastic. It is so fucking fantastic. So this movie is based on a short film also written and directed by Sam H. Freeman and Ng Chun Ping. I apologize if I mispronounced that name. They did a short that premiered at South By. It was a BIFFA winning short. And this is sort of their feature adaptation of it. What's interesting is, so this movie stars Nathan Stewart Jarrett, who people will remember from... from Candyman. He was the gay brother in Candyman. And then it also stars George MacKay, who I always confuse with Harris Dickinson, which is funny because in the short film, Harris Dickinson played George MacKay's character. But it's a little funny, but like they're both very British. Harris Dickinson's more of a pretty boy than George MacKay is, but I see them and I feel like I've seen George MacKay in more movies than I actually have seen him in, because
he look just like fucking Harris Dickinson. He really does.
He's a little bit more rough around the edges than Harris Dickinson is, but he looks like him. He was in 1917. That's the, I think his big movie.
Yes. Anyway.
But anyway, so
British boys.
Nathan plays a character named Jules, who is a femme queer person who does drag shows, and it opens up with him preparing for a drag show, and while he's outside having a smoke, he notices Preston, played by George MacKay, who's sort of lingering outside, and he sort of makes eyes with him, and then Preston leaves. And then later that night, Preston with his group of hooligans accost him in full drag regalia as he is buying cigarettes, and it turns into a vicious homophobic attack that leaves Jules broken, bruised, and struggling from severe PTSD to the point that he doesn't want to leave the house.
Can I ask a question that we can cut out?
Yeah.
Is there sexual assault involved in the attack?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Nope, no sexual assault. Just very vicious beating.
Yeah. No, that is also terrible. I just, like, it's one of those things of, like, you know what I mean, in terms of context about, you never, when someone says homophobic beating, you never really know, like, how,
right.
Some people have a very interesting different ideas of what that means, so.
Right.
I feel like people might want that full context.
Absolutely.
Of, like, what to expect.
Yeah.
Anyway. Cool. So, okay, well, that's.
Yeah, on the scale of horrible things.
Better than I guess it could have been.
Yeah,
I
but
don't know. Anyway.
But he is left really broken. He doesn't want to do drag anymore. He stays home and he plays Street Fighter. He plays Chun-Li, which is great. And then one day he goes to the sauna, to a gay sauna, and while he's there, he sees Preston, the person that he was making eyes with earlier, that was then beating him up, and he wants revenge. And so what this movie does incredibly well is it makes you realize just how bad situations can be for someone that is very queer presenting, particularly when they're femme, because as Jules starts to follow Preston, Preston does not recognize him as the person that he attacked. They start kind of dating in a very weird way. And so we have Jules, and so this movie is very multifaceted. It's very complex. It has a lot of conflicting things going on. And if you just follow, if you didn't know the attack that happened, it feels like a very dom sub relationship that starts to develop between the two, to the point where, like, Preston orders Jules to do something and then says good boy after that. So, like, there is an element of, like, dom and sub that is happening in this, but the power dynamics start to change, and it's complicated by the fact that Jules was savagely beaten by this man. And there's issues of consent. There's issues of consent that raises up because, and this is really early on in the movie, but so it's not really a spoiler, but Jules is looking up revenge porn, And so there's that angle that is happening as well. So like this is a morass of
very complicated. This is my shit.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Very complicated, uncomfortable situations. Every single time Jules is with Preston, particularly when Jules is at his house and around his friends, it is so tense because you just one false move and it feels like, you know, they're going to turn on him and it's going to be horrible. So the movie...
You ready for the rabid dogs to really start showing their fucking teeth, which exactly. is scary.
Exactly. And this movie, at no point in this movie, aside from the brief moment that he's at the sauna, does he feel safe. And the way the movie unfolds is very... The power dynamics involved, the way in which the two of them... start to like appreciate each other, but then also there's like an element that you're just waiting for the shoe to drop. It's like it's a very complex movie. There's a lot of things going on. I absolutely loved it. Fantastic. It is out this week in theaters on the East Coast, I believe, and it's going to spread to LA, and then it will hit everywhere. I think by the 5th of April is where it's supposed to be out, so it'll be coming your way. But the embargo is up this week, and I had to share it because it's so fucking good.
I have heard literally nothing but amazing things about this movie, and like, we don't get queer revenge movies like this, and I'm so fucking excited to see it. Like, I've heard such, and like every review on Letterboxd is like glowing. So I'm stoked to see like a really good, nuanced queer revenge movie.
Yeah.
That it's, like is it sounds like it's kind of taking the rape revenge tropes, but like putting them in like a same sex context in a way that I find incredibly interesting. So I'm so excited to watch it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that from you. I'm so stoked.
It's so good. It's so good. And it's weirdly to say, it's really sexy. Which is weird to say, considering...
Oh, I love it. That makes me so happy that it's so serious and also really hot. I know that sounds problematic, but there's a way to do it. We saw it in the 80s. We saw it in the 90s. And God damn it, Terry and I have been begging for this.
Have been.
For years.
And it's weird to say that because, like, at the heart, like, it's a very toxic relationship that develops. But it is also, like, I don't know. There's something about it, particularly with when we're talking about it, you know, BDSM and sort of dom and sub. It's just, I don't know. There's something really exciting about this movie. It kind of reminded me, like, I could see this being set in, like, Carter Smith's, like, All the Dead Boys, like, type world without, like, anything horror.
Say no more, fam.
But, like, that is sort of the vibe that it's giving, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Gritty, gross.
Yep.
But sexy. You're like, I'm a little bit scared and it seems really dangerous, but I'm also incredibly erect. Oh. Sorry, but, like... It's the vibe Carter's photos give me. Leave me alone.
Same.
And Carter's listening to this.
Same.
He knows what he's doing. That man is very aware of what he's doing.
Uh-huh. And speaking of which, if you haven't signed up for All the Dead Boys, he sends out an email every Friday and it has glorious pictures. So get on that if that is of interest to you. but that's Femme. I loved it. It lived up to the hype for me. It was everything I wanted it to be. I loved it. People who don't have media literacy are probably going to have problems with this film, though.
If I see one more fucking take about Poor Things, I'm going... It's my 13th reason. If I see one more person... I don't have the energy for this right now, but people saying that movie is misogynistic, I don't want to be that person, but I just don't agree with you.
No,
like,
exactly.
I don't think we watch the same movie.
No.
But that's fine.
All right. Let's hear about South By.
Okay. I'm going to try to keep this, like, super brief, but I've seen, like, some really cool shit at South By. I've watched 6 movies, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, like, hey, most of them are the Midnighters, and I feel very happy about that. And I have seen some really good stuff. There's some weird shit coming out of South By that I'm super stoked about. I think my first favorite that, unsurprisingly, is Oddity. Which is Damian McCarthy's new movie, guided caveat, this is his new horror movie about a woman named Darcy whose twin sister was brutally murdered, and she goes back to her sister's house to figure out what happened with the help of this giant wooden golem, essentially. And if you thought caveat was scary, you're gonna shit your pants watching Oddity. It's everything about caveat, but like the fear stuff ratcheted up to like a ridiculous amount. It's the whole movie rather than like the jump scares at the end. And it's really impressive, again, to see McCarthy continue to make these really incredible, scary, weird movies that just have such an incredibly rancid vibe. Yeah. So lives up to the hype. That's going to be on Shudder later this year. Yeah, this one's going to fuck you up just the same, if not more. This one fucked me up more than caveat. I watched it pitch black, headphones on, knowing what I was doing. But again, like, I wanted to because I knew what this movie was. And it was like, this is a movie that demands my full attention in like my perfect viewing setting. And I regret nothing about that. I jumped so hard. Steve was like, what is wrong with you?
I can't wait.
I almost pulled a muscle, like, jumping at some of these parts. So,
I can't wait.
That was an incredible one. I know. I was really, really excited about how good that one was. The next one is Things Will Be Different. This director is the editor for all of Benson Moorhead's stuff, essentially. Okay. He's been working with them since Resolution. They executive produced it. It is incredible. It is a very Benson and Moorhead movie in terms of like emotional sci-fi, but this one is time travel. Brother and sister basically come together after the sister robs bank or pulls off a robbery. They run to a safe house, and at the safe house they discover some way to help themselves that involves time travel, but the entities that allow the time travel do not like them fucking with these things. Mm. And so they are given a set of instructions by these entities so that they will survive. Which sounds really silly, but it's single location, very grounded, like mumblegore, but less mumblegore aesthetics. Acting is incredible. I loved it. I think, again, it's like not maybe everyone's cup of tea, but I think that the emotional storytelling plus the weird world building on top of it make it a really cool watch, especially as an experiment for low budget indie sci-fi filmmaking. Like, it is possible. You can do it in a really interesting way without it being like aliens everywhere and like lightsabers and like guns. It's a really another just like really well written, well thought out, like heartfelt example of good sci-fi, like weird sci-fi. So I absolutely adored that. There's two other films that I'll talk about, both Bachelor Party films, but inversions of the Bachelor Party film.
I saw your tweet about
these. Which was very interesting to see. Yeah, so there is Bird Eater, which is Australian, which is essentially a woman is invited to her husband or her fiance's bachelor party, and the bachelor party goes weird. But the movie starts with setting up their dynamic as incredibly manipulative and fucked up. So when they finally get to the bachelor party about 20 minutes in, everything already feels very weird between like what the couple's dynamic is. And then it just gets worse as the night goes on. And it's just like 2 hours spent with the worst people you've ever met, which sucks. But like, it's an important movie about, it's specifically about Australian masculinity. But I think it also speaks to like larger issues of masculinity, because like, it's mostly about like male friends not holding their other friends accountable and letting them get away with like the most fucked up shit imaginable and not giving a shit. And it captures that very well, in a way that makes you deeply uncomfortable, which is good, but it's just like, it's not a movie you want to watch when you're like not in the best headspace, especially if you've experienced any kind of like manipulation or abuse from a partner. It's like, it's very good, it's very well done, but it's just like, Jesus fucking Christ. And then on the flip side, so that is Bird Eater, directed by two men from Australia. And then there's Hunting Days, which is a French-Canadian film directed by a woman, Annick Blanc. And it is from the perspective of a sex worker who was hired by a bachelor party. And then she has to call one of them to come pick her up because her car broke down. She is then reintegrated back into their little microcosm of society, but as one of them and not the sex worker. And there is just a lot going on with, like, power dynamics and, like, is she really into this or is she just trying to survive, and, like, plays with this idea of, like, what is her goal here, and, like, what does she need? And then a stranger is introduced, and then, like, everything is thrown out of whack. So it just, like, these two movies do a really, it's really weird, like, bachelor parties, but I think it's also important because we see, like, The Hangover, and, like, we talked about a bachelor party movie on the podcast. I totally forgot the fucking name, but it was with all the shitty men.
Very Bad Things.
Yeah. So, like, we know that the bachelor, like, the male bachelor party is, like, always a subject of, like, comedy of, like, haha, look at the guys cheating and doing fucked up shit. It's so funny. But these movies are now being like, hey, guys, maybe we shouldn't be encouraging men to go on long weekends where they do fucked up shit and then hide it from their partners. Like, perhaps not the smartest move on our part as a culture or a society.
Yep.
So these movies are, like, very interesting, not just saying they're bad, but, like, actually very much more deeply interrogating, like, male masculine microcosms that form and, like, toxic male things that kind of come out of these weird hierarchies that form in male social circles. It's very interesting. But yeah, so there's just some really cool shit at South By. I didn't see any of, like, the big things, like Monkey Man, because I'm watching it, I'm doing it virtually, but...
Right.
Yeah, some really good, weird things coming out of South By, as always. But I was really pleased. Everything I've watched, I've really quite enjoyed.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Those movies sound great. I'm really excited for Oddity, though. Like, that is... I'm very excited for that one. I need to see that one.
Yeah, it's good. It's one of those things where no one had seen it yet, because I got a screener before the fest. And I watched it, and I was like, am I crazy? Am I wrong? Like, it's one of those things where, like, you know you're not, but you're, like, it's weird when, like, you're one of the first people to see something, or, like, you can't put anything up from an embargo, and you're just like, well, I thought it was good, trying to trust my instincts and not, like, go, and not be like, alright, this is where I fall, but you just have to kind of trust yourself that it's good. Yeah. And, thankfully, other people agree, so. But yeah, so that's a good, quick TLDR about South By. But we're getting to Terry's most anticipated part of the episode, because now we are talking about Blue Men and Habsburgs, aka we are starting our discussion about 30 Rock as Terry is guiding me through the world of 30 Rock, one episode at a time, one episode of Little Cuts at a time.
My favorite episodes. And so this episode, we are talking about Tracy Does Conan and Black Tie, which is episode 7 and episode 12 of season 1. And Mary Beth, in some ways, I feel like kind of tossed you a little bit into the deep end with these two, because they're wild. But what I got to know, what were your thoughts about these two episodes? Let's start with, Tracy Does Conan.
Yeah. Well, I was excited to jump into this. Hold on, sorry. I, like, just clicked on it to just make sure, like, I had my brain up, and then everything was yelling at me. But I was excited, because, like, I enjoy the concept of 30 Rock. I haven't really watched it, and I was like, I'm excited for a 30 Rock connoisseur to guide me through. And I was not disappointed with these two episodes, because I knew that 30 Rock was chaos. Like, I was not worried about being in the deep end, because I just feel like 30 Rock to me is just, like, chaos incarnate. And that's great. I love that. I forget that Liz Lemon really is a dickhead. And I love that, though.
She is.
I love how much she sucks. I think not enough people, at least when it was coming out, talked about how much she sucks and how that's on purpose. And I think so many people want to be like, no, she's like this cool... Not that I think I see this a lot, but it's like, I think there was this idea of like, oh, she's like the every woman. She's like just like a girl. And I'm like, no. And I know they do this more like later on when they talk about her as a teenager. But I just love that they make her kind of insufferable. Like, you can kind of see why, like, no one wants to date her and, like, why she kind of is in this position. Like, she kind of sucks in a way that is, like, minorly endearing. Yeah. But I do appreciate that this show was making, like, a not... Especially compared to, like, Jenna Krakowski's character, who is outwardly, like, the worst. But then you have Liz, who is just, like, an everyday kind of bitch.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I don't mean that as a bad thing. I'm kind of glad she's a bitch. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of love that she sucks.
One thing I think the show does really well, particularly as we get further in the show, is sort of she thinks that she is like this liberal altruistic person, but then we start to see that like it's white femininity, it's white feminism, it's not necessarily like everything that we think it should be. And so I do love, particularly on like rewatches and sort of getting to understand what is happening behind the scenes of this, she is a horrible person, but she's also just incredibly endearing, and I love her.
Yeah, but then on top of that, I just forgot about how insane Tracy and Jenna's characters are, and just like
and
how
they get more so,
and just like the things that come out of her mouth, like Jenna's mouth, are my favorite. Of just like explaining, like, and I know that's the bit, but I just love the bit with her just like sharing, like, oh, that happened here, or like when Tracy sees the blue man and goes, "Blue man, where your feet at?" And like, who cares? Like, why? Who cares? It's just like a lot of grounded conversations about business, but then contrasted with outward, like, hallucinogenic madness. And I'm like, wait, this show is rad in the way that it juggles like trying to be a grounded workplace comedy paired with like, because this is the Office did never do this. The Office like got silly, but it never got as ridiculous as 30 Rock gets, and I love that about 30 Rock and just how outlandish and nuts, like Tracy being off his meds and just like
he's calling for Dr. Spaceman.
Oh, Spaceman.
And his name actually is Spaceman. It's just pronounced Spaceman. Because of course
Dr.
it is.
Dr. Spaceman. I knew about Dr. Spaceman. And the voice, the guy who plays Dr. Spaceman is the voice of a character on Archer.
He is, yes. Absolutely.
I love it. Tracy Does Conan was a good intro for me back into the dynamics of everybody, especially yeah. with like how Liz interacts with Alec Baldwin's character, and then like how they go, and then how she comes back down to like the writer's room, and then the actors and the writers. Like, it's a really good look at just like the dynamics of the whole show and like the hierarchy of everything in case, yeah. like, again, like me, I'm jumping into it. It's a funny primer, but it's a good primer of just like, this is where everyone stands in this scenario, and like, this is the dynamic of how everything goes for the most part.
And see, and this is why shows need some time to breathe, because this is episode 7, and this is where like the surrealness starts to like creep into the show. I believe that like the first 6 episodes, there are some, you know, wild moments in it, but for the most part, it kind of feels more like more grounded in a way. And I feel like this episode is where, because this one was written by Tina Fey, and I feel like this episode is sort of where they're like, you know what, let's just start to go for a while, because who knows if the show is going to even get renewed, is what it feels like.
I like to walk around the house naked so my son is reminded who has the biggest ding dong.
This has like one of my most favorite lines of the entire show, though, where the whole setup is that Liz is keeps like running up to Jack's office because he says that he needs like a joke. And so she keeps coming up there trying to give him a joke. And then she finds out that that's not even a now issue. It's like months away.
She's having
the worst day of her life. Her blood sugar is so low because she gave blood and she has not been able to eat anything. And she's like, why are you wearing a tux? And the way, you know, Alec Baldwin, he's a horrible person, but the way he turns around and looks at her like, what? And he's like, what am I? A farmer? Or no, it's after 6.
It's a 6, Lemon. What am I? A farmer?
The way he says it, like, and the way he looks at her is just, it's my favorite line. And the delivery from him is just so perfect.
But like, Alec Baldwin sucks ass.
He does.
He's perfect for this role because he really fucking sucks.
He does.
And the way he's able to, like, play, like, a smarmy exec, I'm like, yeah. Yeah. He's got a good voice.
He does. He has a very good voice.
Did you see him get roasted? His roast?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. He's a bad man. He's a bad man.
The things that he said to his daughter on that voice, man. Ugh.
Unconscionable.
Been there. So... he sucks, but this show rules. So anyway, we had to talk about it because Alex Baldwin.
as a page.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah.
She's a page. I know.
She
I was
like, a page in real life, too.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yeah. I always hear those, like, the stories about, well, about her. But I also, Liz Lemon always has the issues of dating. And so she dates the guy from the Allstate commercials. Again, yeah. That's all I know him from. Love him. And like, I just love that he's kind of a dumb, like a himbo. But again, love the dynamic of her, like him being annoying, but also sweet, and her not knowing like how to deal with that. Incredible.
Yeah.
10 out of 10. Yeah. I don't know. I just, again, I love showing her as kind of like a normal kind of like egotistical dickhead, mm-hmm. but like not in the same way that Alec Baldwin is. It's a little bit more subtle.
Yeah.
And again, I appreciate that, especially in a show from this era and discussing like a woman in a leadership position.
I also just want to point out the structure of this, because I think this is one of the best written episodes, because I love how there's multiple storylines. We have the A storyline, we have like with Liz trying to get Tracy ready for the Conan show. We have Jenna, who is trying to get everyone to understand the Rurger that she cannot pronounce. And so she is like really upset that she's been kicked off the show. So we're following her. We have Kenneth, who is out to Rite Aid when there's a Rite Aid on every single corner to find drugs for we have Pete wearing a toupee because Jack says it makes him look powerful.
Oh,
and it all
so
kind of
powerful.
It
I
all converges. He's kind of gross later on in the show. He's not a great person. But I love how all these stories like converge at the very end with Pete like using the power of his toupee to like part the sea so that Kenneth can get to him. There's just all these little things, like the way it's plotted, it's so good, where we allow these character moments, but then everything comes together in a hilarious climax. And I think this episode in particular is plotted so incredibly well.
I definitely agree with that, especially with her coming home about to break up with the boyfriend and then passing out with the hamburger from McDonald's in her hand. This is, like, the kind of episode I think of when I think of 30 Rock. Just, like, very hectic and, like, very... The show to me feels very New York, like, when I think about it. Just in terms of, like, the frenetic pacing, the go, go, go. 600 different things happening at one time. Go, go, go. And
so
it all,
jokes.
Like, somehow works out. But there's just, like, constantly jokes, jokes, jokes. And, like, dry affectations. There isn't, like, we're not just saying it and letting everyone laugh. This isn't, like, a sitcom. This is about people who write comedy for a living. And so, yeah.
And I read somewhere that like the joke to minute ratio is like really incredibly high on this show compared to like normal sitcoms, because it's just like one after another. And if one joke doesn't work, don't worry, in 2 seconds there's going to be another one that will tug at your funny bone. It's just, I don't know. It's great. But then we get to Black Tie with Paul Reubens playing the last male descendant of the Habsburg family. I didn't even know until this show who the Habsburg were. I didn't know anything about that. So this show has educated me on the defenestration of Prague in Habsburg.
We joke that Misu has a Habsburg chin all the time. Because if you used to get her at a certain angle, she has like the distinctive, like blocky chin that you see in paintings of the family that they are known for. So I'm dying because I make reference to this family all the time because my fucking cat, I always joke that she's inbred, which is not funny, but like she comes from a weird cat colony of like only a Siamese cat. So I'm like, she's probably kind of inbred. So this made me laugh and I was like, oh, I shouldn't be laughing at inbred jokes in 2024.
but it's so funny. I hate how funny this episode is.
I know. And like it's Paul Reubens and it's obviously like him in a wheelchair, like with fake hands and like fake body, and it's like
white one hand.
Oh, I know. And like Jenna is there wanting to like romance him, but then oh my god. I'm like, this is so terrible, but I have to laugh. I can't help it. Oh, it's terrible. And Will Arnett plays his fucking page with his terrible haircut.
What's funny is that Will Arnett comes back in later episodes, not as this character, but as someone completely different who dates Jenna.
Oh my god, that makes me so happy.
He's a straight drag queen that dresses up as Jenna, like that is his thing. And so of course Jenna is in love with him because Jenna's in love with herself. So that's later on, but yeah, he has a brief moment in this as the assistant to the Habsburg, and it's hilarious. I love how Paul Reubens will like go from like talking normal to just all of a sudden shouting. He gets introduced and he's like, "Thank you all, dear friends, for coming to my birthday." His performance is so fucking hilarious. But so fucking hilarious. Yeah.
Also, we learned that Isabel Rossellini plays Jack's ex-wife.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Terry about this before we pressed play or record, but, like, the show really was, like, in the golden age of celeb cameos on TV. And yeah. I just did not expect to see Isabel Rossellini, like,
no.
Queen herself as, like, the jealous ex who Jack misses and she's toxic about. It's just very good to see.
I love her line where she thinks that, you know, that Liz is dating Jack because Jack doesn't want to be seen alone meeting his ex-wife who is seeing her fiance. And so at one point, Bianca, Isabella Rossellini's character, sidles up to Liz Lemon and says, "Are you going to marry Jack?" And then she's like, "He's going to get you knocked up, a little late in life baby." And then her true colors come out. She's like, "Makes me want to vomit." And she says that you can actually make him happy, and that makes me want to sit on a knife. Just like the viciousness that comes out of her is so unexpectedly hilarious.
It's just so good. And I love when Jenna shows up at the party and Liz is like, "What are you doing here? If you look pretty enough and confident enough, you'll let you in." "Oh, so you showed the security guards your boobs?" "Just one." "What is this?
The White House."
"It's not the White House."
Oh my god. And I love them. And this is like the kind of start of their sort of Liz and hers very toxic codependent relationship, where they're in the bathroom and Jenna is like, "I think I can go through with this," because she wants to marry a prince. And of course, Habsburg is not the prince that she was anticipating. But she is like talking about this and Liz is like, "Are you really going through with this?" And she's just keeps going on and she's not listening to Liz at all. And she's like, "Poop, monkey butt." And Liz, "No, you're a good friend."
You are a good friend. It's like, is it in the seventh episode or another episode where Jenna talks about the roommate Liz had and like goes, "That was you." Yeah. And she's like, "I'm in character, and if you make me do the dishes, I'm going to kill myself."
It's so ridiculous. Flashback
to the past, and they play themselves in the past, and they just like, I don't know, that just makes me cackle this whole series. But
it's so good. Yay, I'm really glad that you enjoyed them, because like, you know, I have watched these so many times that I can quote them ad nauseum. But like, and I realize watching this in 2024, there's some things in it that are definitely cringe. And I have definitely seen some things that I'm just like, ooh, I don't think that was appropriate back then, let alone now. But there's something about it that just, this episode, by the way, was written by Kay Cannon, who would go on to do Pitch Perfect. And I think,
Okay.
I think you can kind of see that sense of crazy humor and like frenetic humor that I think made the first Pitch Perfect in particular work. You can see, I think, a direct line from this episode.
And I'm sorry, I was just like playing it to make sure. And then when he loses his eyebrow, confessing his love to her, and his eyebrow falls off into his dessert as he's declaring his love an eyebrow. Yeah, I think you lost an eyebrow. And he's just like, "To love." It's just like, This and then he just, can't like, isn't afraid.
Metabolize the grapes. And so he dies. Yep.
And then he died. Yeah, like, I don't.
We got a boogie gang. I love when she comes, when Jenna comes running over to Jack and Elizabeth's like, we got a boogie gang.
Especially after she gets like, after she gets fucking attacked, especially after Liz gets attacked by Isabel Rossellini's character, gets like her tit, like her dress ripped down and her tits exposed. Oh man. Yeah, I'm excited to keep watching. I'm very excited.
Yay. Well, the next little cuts, we're going to continue with the 30 Rock, but we are moving directly into season two. I'll be honest, season one is not my favorite of the seasons. There are some good moments, but like season two is where it starts to like really hit. And so we're going to keep these celebrity cameos going with the season four and five episodes, Rosemary's Baby, which stars Princess Leia, and Greenzo, which stars former friend Ross.
Wow. Okay. Very exciting.
Yeah. So that's going to be on our next little cuts if you want to follow along with us for our 30 Rock series. But Mary Beth, who are we chatting with next week?
So next week we are chatting with Erlinger Thordsen, the writer and director of the queer ghost story Rift, the writer of Midnight Kiss, which was directed by former guest of the show and current friend of the show, Carter Smith. Mm-hmm. And his latest film, The Piper, is out now on VOD. So we are very excited to have him on the show to talk about In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes, In the Mouth of Madness. Give me some John Carpenter
goodness. I totally forgot I saw.
Same. I mean, I hadn't forgotten, but I forgot everything about the movie.
Oh, no, fully forgot I saw this movie. So, yeah, great. Great work, everyone. Great job, brain. But listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. Did you watch anything this week that we watch and have thoughts? Do you have suggestions for 30 Rock episodes for me to watch? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram. Please do not forget to vote for us in the rondos.
Please.
Please and thank you.
Please, please, please. And don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe, as well as supporting us through the rondos. Don't forget to support us through Patreon if you can. We have a new Fresh Wounds episode coming up this month as well. I'm really excited for that one. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there. Most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.